I think it's important to recognize that you can't have 100% security and also then have 100% privacy and zero inconvenience.
After leaks about widespread surveillance, President Obama tells Americans not to worry. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. But national security reporters are stunned by both the extent of the leaks and the programs they exposed.
We're put in a position when we don't know what's being done with that information to sort of just trust that the government's using it appropriately. And unfortunately, history tells us that's not always a wise assumption.
And in Turkey, the repression of the media has its roots in the government's ruthless dismantling of an equally ruthless shadow state.
It is absolutely extraordinary. That's what makes it so hard. The truth is so fantastic that you can't dismiss it as a conspiracy theory.
All that and more coming up.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Since Thursday, a cascade of revelations confirmed what most of us really already kind of knew but preferred not to dwell on, that our government has access to records about our phone calls and our credit card purchases, as well as the emails, online photos, file transfers, chats, and, well, who knows what else, of foreigners. After the British Guardian newspaper printed a leaked document showing that the U.S. National Security Agency had regular access to the phone records of millions of Verizon customers, WNYC's Brian Lehrer show took some calls.
Lamar in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning to both of you. I don't understand what the concern is when we never hear any of your guests reference the fact that this country is at war. And therefore, these intrusive security measures are necessary based on supposedly protecting us from the events that happened in Boston and from 9/11.
The government's surveillance powers are derived under the Post-9/11 Patriot Act, renewed in 2006 and in 2011, by Congress, the people who are elected to protect our democracy and our homeland, not necessarily in that order. And when it comes to surveillance, all that's partisan melts into air. Here are Republicans Mike Rogers and Saxby Chambliss and Democrat Dianne Feinstein.
This program was used to stop a terrorist attack in the United States. We know that. It is legal. It's been authorized by Congress.
We have gathered significant information on bad guys, but only on bad guys over the years.
It's to ferret this out before it happens. It's called protecting America.
Of course, there have been congressional critics, too. Libertarians Ron and Rand Paul, Democratic Socialist Bernie Sanders, mainstream Democrats like Dick Durbin, Mark Udall, and Ron Wyden. But only legislators on the relevant committees knew much about the programs, and they weren't allowed to talk about them.
When it comes to the Verizon revelations and later allegations about AT&T and Sprint, the government emphasizes that it doesn't listen to the calls or even knows the names of the callers. It's only metadata, that's information about the calls. But don't underestimate that data's revelatory power, says Shane Harris, author of The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State.
First off, we've never seen an order actually from the intelligence court that issues these authorities. And it is just sort of the breadth of it. I mean, if you read it, it does say all call detail records. I mean, it's essentially saying everything.
By everything, we mean the phone number of every caller and recipient, the serial number of the phones, the time and duration of each phone call, and potentially the location of each of the participants when the call happened.
That's right. The idea here is that if investigators have a telephone number, say, of a suspected or a known terrorist, and they want to find out who else that person may have been talking to in the U.S., they can take that number, run it against this metadatabase of phone numbers, and if they find hits and connections, they can start studying them. Now, if they want to find out the name of that person that the suspect has been talking to, they can go get a warrant to do that.
So let's just say, hypothetically, that the government has been collecting, since 2006, all the metadata from all the phone companies of all the customers in the United States. Why?
It's so that if someone does pop up in the future, we've got a record that we can go back and trace his communications, his associations back as far as we can go. Now, the important other question with that, though, is the only thing that they're doing with this information, comparing phone numbers of people who pop up on the counterterrorism radar? I don't think so. I mean, I've done a lot of reporting on this in my book. And what you find is that once the NSA has this information, they like to try and analyze it for all kinds of different things, doing pattern analysis and trying to graph it to figure out where the terrorist networks are. It's not just being used for this one purpose of comparing it to phone numbers. We're put in the position when we don't know what's being done with that information to sort of just trust that the government's using it appropriately.
Senator Lindsey Graham was on Fox and Friends Thursday, and he said it's not a big deal because it's only being used for one purpose.
I don't think you're talking to terrorists. I know you're not. I know I'm not, so we don't have anything to worry about.
I suppose that it is true that most people in this country, I think, presume that, well, they don't have anything to hide, so fine, if it can help prevent a terrorist attack, then let them keep it. But what we do have to understand is that there is a history with these agencies of violating people's privacy, of overreach, and that we should have some more robust oversight, I think, of this process, other than senators coming out and saying, oh, we've known about this for years, there's nothing to worry about.
On Twitter Thursday, a lot of reporters responded to this with a great big meh, saying that they figured this was going on. So why is this story eliciting such a strong reaction in some quarters and such a shrug in others?
You know, I'm somebody who's written a book about this, and I was still stunned by it. I can't think of any piece of paper that has ever been leaked out of this court. There's maybe been one opinion ever released by it under the Freedom of Information Act.
We're talking about the FISA court.
Correct. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which was set up to oversee this process of surveillance for intelligence and counterterrorism purposes. We've just never seen the document. And when you sort of sit down and look at it and its breadth, it is a bit breathtaking. This actually gives us a window now right into the heart of where these decisions are made. And I do think that that makes this an extraordinary revelation, even if we already knew, yeah, the government was collecting tons and tons of data about us. This is a really, really huge leak, and I presume it will be fully investigated.
Shane, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Senior Washingtonian writer Shane Harris is the author of The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State. Last December, as Congress was approving 5 more years of the FISA law allowing warrantless surveillance of Americans' overseas communications, Democratic Senator Ron Wyden addressed a mostly empty chamber.
Colleagues, it is not real oversight when the United States Congress cannot get a yes or no answer to the question of whether an estimate currently exists as to whether law-abiding Americans have had their phone calls and emails swept up under the FISA law.
Wyden's concern was focused mostly on Section 215 of the Patriot Act, which the government interpreted secretly to mean something more than it actually said.
Section 215 of the Patriot Act, on its face, says that the government can obtain certain kinds of information using a court order if it can demonstrate that the information is relevant to an authorized foreign intelligence or international terrorism investigation.
Elizabeth Goitein is the co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice.
So we've just learned that the government and, in fact, a secret court both interpret this provision to allow the government to obtain any and all information, regardless of whether there's any relevance, as long as it agrees not to actually search the information until it has more of a reason to think that there's some wrongdoing going on. For years, the few senators who have actually known about these secret interpretations, because they serve on the Intelligence Committee and so they're privy, like Ron Wyden, like Mark Udall, like Senator Feingold before them, some of those senators have raised an alarm and said there is an interpretation of the law that looks entirely different from what the law actually says. But until now, no one has known how the law is being interpreted and applied.
So if under the government's interpretation, they can collect all this stuff, but they really can't search it unless they have a reason to believe that there's a threat, why are we worried?
There's been a long and inglorious history of the government misusing information to target social activists and political enemies, and even on some occasion, personal enemies. The Church Committee in the 1970s studied administrations going back to FDR and found that across administration that these abuses had been commonplace. We've seen some examples of it recently as well. In 2010, there was an Inspector General report at the Department of Justice that found that the FBI was investigating anti-war protests. And there have been even more, I would say, instances recently of government officials misusing information for personal reasons, using information to stalk ex-girlfriends or, you know, find out things about their neighbors. You know, the government most of the time is using this information for all the right purposes, but there is a tremendous potential for abuse.
What about the response of intelligence officials saying that this leak was reprehensible, that we've damaged our security?
It's very hard to evaluate that claim. And every time the government is pressed for some explanation or example of an instance in which it's kept us safe, they say, well, we can't talk about that. In terms of the evidence that we see for the usefulness of data mining, and data mining is really the only possible reason to be gathering all of the phone records of all Americans. Data mining has not been shown yet to be useful in identifying patterns of behavior that are correlated with would-be terrorists.
As the president said on Friday, they're collecting the information. They won't have permission to actually use it unless they smell something fishy.
One thing we don't know yet is the information itself being used to determine whether there's a reason to use it. And what I mean by that is the government running computer programs that will flag people they want to look at more closely, and then they say, now we have a reason to look at this person because the computer flagged it. That's sort of the equivalent of sending dogs into your house to sniff around for drugs, and then when they bark, saying, oh, well, now we can get a warrant.
Well, if it weren't drugs and it were a bomb, would you feel the same way?
I would. Now, if the government has a reason to think that there's a bomb there, then the government can get a warrant. Do we want to say that the government can walk into each and every one of our houses whenever it wants just to check because they know that somebody somewhere has a bomb? I was listening to the president's remarks today, and he kept saying, I'm glad we're having this conversation. This is what we need to be thinking about as a country. And I couldn't help but think, how can he say that he welcomes the conversation, that he wants to have a conversation, when the government did everything in its power to prevent this conversation from happening until this leak happened?
So I wonder if there'll be really vigorous leak investigations now.
Oh, there will be. There will be.
Elizabeth, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Elizabeth Goitein is co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. This is NPR. On the Media is supported by Air France, the official carrier for Marseille-Provence 2013, European Capital of Culture. A major attraction of the Provence region are the beaches of Nice and Cannes, which are known for sunbathing, discos, high-end shopping, and restaurants, whereas Antibes and the Cap d'Antibes, about halfway between Nice and Cannes, offer a quieter beach vacation. Tickets and information on daily flights to Nice and Marseille are available at airfrance.us.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Nearly 2 weeks ago, a small group of Turkish environmentalists were attacked with tear gas and water cannons while protesting a government plan to redevelop Istanbul's Gezi Park into a shopping center and mosque. The violent overreaction, and the deputy prime minister has admitted it was that, touched off ongoing protests in every major Turkish city. It's not about trees anymore. It's about Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan's perceived abuse of power and indifference to opposing views. On Thursday, he claimed the demonstrations have, quote, lost their democratic credentials and turned to vandalism. On Wednesday, Turkish media reported that authorities had arrested 25 people for allegedly spreading false rumors through social media. He called the protesters çapulca, the Turkish word for looters, a term they have embraced, as you can hear in this version of a popular song posted on YouTube, where the lyrics to Every Day I'm Shuffling have been changed to Every Day I'm Chuffling. One Turkish game show that plays with words found a way to insert terms related to the protests, like Gezi and park and pacifism, into answers on the show.
Gezi.
Hiç harf almadılar. Gezi.
Park.
Halkın gezi.
Pasifizm.
Pasifizm. Gayet iyi bildiğiniz.
In all, the New York Times counted 70 references on the show to the protests.
Twitter.
Twitter.
Including Twitter. Did you catch that? A nod to Twitter's role in informing the public and organizing protests. So Twitter, YouTube, even some game shows weighed in, but Turkish journalist Tulin Dalalo says one group was conspicuously quiet, and that was the mainstream media.
The Turkish media literally did not turn its cameras to its own streets for the first 2-3 days of demonstrations. There is an intense government pressure on the newsrooms, and they have given in because the government is strong. The Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan's party has been elected to power 3 consecutive times. I think the media is just playing politics. The government only prefers to hear the news that provides a good image for them, both domestically and internationally.
Now, you mentioned playing politics, but this is more than just subtle pressure imposed by the Erdogan government. Over the last number of years, many journalists have been jailed, more than even in China or Russia. There have been crippling fines imposed on one media group of something on the order of $1 billion. Is this a simple case of intimidation, fear of prosecution from the government?
Look, I mean, the journalists then do get scared because the question is, well, the government is able to get to our big boss and he's having difficulty. So what happens to us? You know, most of us are not earning too much money. We have families to take care of. For the past decade, we have not seen really any stories about corruption. But if you go to Turkey's streets, if you talk to people on Turkey's streets, well, there's a lot of stories out there.
You're speaking with some experience here. You yourself lost your job. Where were you working and what were the circumstances of your dismissal?
Well, I used to work for a well-known daily Turkish paper named Habertürk up until May 2010. I have been critical about the prime minister's policy toward Israel and the way how he handles his relationship with Syria. And I was told that there was a telephone call from the prime minister's office to the owner of Habertürk, and my contract got terminated soon after. The Habertürk is a privately owned paper. The people that I work with, the people that I thought was taking care of me, were the ones who pushed me under the truck. I'm not the only one. I'm not going to be the last one. There are a lot of others here who have to, you know, change their professions.
When the government has this see no evil, hear no evil approach to terrorism and protests, and when the police react so violently against peaceful demonstrators, is there no public sentiment for change?
The people, the citizen journalists out on the streets do not really care whether the media is doing its job or not. They have taken things into their hands. The social media, Facebook and Twitter, have empowered them, and they're using it to full speed. The Turkish people also celebrate the journalists, the good journalists who are really doing their job. It's not about siding with the government or not siding with the government. It's really not the issue. But the ones who can report the events as is, because that's what's really needed.
Tulin, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Tulin Dalalo is a columnist for Al Monitor, a U.S.-based online publication covering Turkey, and she hosts Turkey Pulse on Twitter. She spoke to us from Ankara. Historically, Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan has consolidated much of his power by raising fears about the threat of domestic terrorism and the so-called deep state, a shadowy network of military and civilian elites who for decades have stifled any perceived threat to a secular Turkey. It's a kind of cabal of unseen hands, often violent, that smacks of conspiracy theory. Except, as New Yorker staff writer Dexter Filkins found out, it actually exists.
It is absolutely extraordinary. I didn't believe it when I started. I thought the deep state was a myth that they had created so they could arrest all these people. And the deep state is a totally real phenomenon. Death squads, secret detention centers, everything. That's what makes it so hard. The truth is so fantastic that you can't dismiss it as a conspiracy theory. I mean, the conspiracy theories are sort of cut in both ways, you know? Like, there is a deep state, like, absolutely, it's crazy, but Erdogan is also exaggerating the threat of the deep state so that he can, like, arrest people. So it's nuts.
And part of that roundup included the press. How did that play out?
When Erdogan came into power, he basically decided, not publicly, but he basically decided he was going to crush the remnants of the deep state. And what he has done over the past, particularly over the past 5 or 6 years, but it's happening right now, is he's arrested hundreds of people, not just military officers, not just police officers, but university presidents, the heads of television stations, newspaper editors, reporters, NGO activists. The net has just widened and widened and widened.
It's become a kind of get-into-jail-free card for him.
If you start to criticize the government, you better run for cover. And there's a growing sense in the West that Erdogan, you know, may have started with good intentions about sort of going after the remnants of this kind of, you know, this weird organization, but that he's gone way too far. And that basically he's kind of reaching for authoritarianism. And I think that's a pretty fair criticism. Turkey imprisons more journalists than any country in the world. And that includes Iran, it includes China, it includes Russia. Turkey, if you measure it by journalists put in prison, is the most repressive country in the world. It's something that you don't hear a lot about in the United States because I think Turkey is a pretty modern country and its economy has been booming for the last 10 years. And they're in a really crummy part of the world. They're in a part of the world which is always in upheaval and been very violent and where, frankly, the United States doesn't have a lot of friends. And so we've been kind of very happy with Erdogan and to have him as an ally and somebody that we can talk to and somebody who appears to share most of our values. So you don't hear a lot about the repressive things that he's doing.
Is he Mubarak? Is he Hugo Chavez? Is he Putin? Who is this guy?
I think Erdogan is Erdogan. I mean, he's very much a product of Turkey's pretty unique political history and religious tradition. I mean, there's elements of him which, you know, the kind of the populist tough guy. So, you know, is that Chavez or Putin or whoever? I do think that if he doesn't stop, if he keeps going, he's going down a pretty dangerous road. And there's a lot of indications today, and again, you know, we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, but Erdogan, who's been prime minister since 2002, wants to be president, and he wants to rewrite the constitution, put it before the people, but essentially expanding the powers of the presidency and then run for president himself. So, you know, if he has his way, he's going to have a lot of power and he's going to be in power for probably another decade at least. So all those things, again, I mean, those are very suggestive of authoritarian, anti-democratic impulses on his part.
The CEO of one of the largest media groups, which happens to be part of a conglomerate with even more to lose, apologized to his own staff at his biggest TV channel for, in his words, betraying the audience by not doing a more credible job covering the protests and the police overreaction. If he's willing to go out on a limb, do you think it's plausible that the rest of the Turkish media will begin to feel its oats as well?
I think so. I mean, that's a remarkable development. You hear these stories, you know, they're true. I think of how intimidating Erdogan's government has been with the press, to the point where Erdogan would just call in the editors of the big newspapers and television stations in Turkey, and he'd say, okay, this is what's going to happen, and I don't want to hear any criticism about it from you guys. Okay, end of meeting. Is that ICE starting to crack. Maybe. We've all seen this 100 times in other countries when people begin to get angry and the pent-up frustrations start to come out. You know, events can move very, very quickly, and that's happening here. And so while Erdogan 3 weeks ago may have been one of the most popular leaders in the world, 3 weeks from now he may not be. And so I think the Turkish press has been intimidated, cowed, beaten up, imprisoned, all that. And maybe we're starting to see that change.
Dexter, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Dexter Filkins is a staff writer at The New Yorker.
Turkey has been convulsed by political protest for 7 days. Now the Prime Minister is back with a rousing message for his followers.
Her ne yapacaksak, demokrasi içinde yapacağız.
Whatever we do it within democracy. Whatever we do it with the law. We, 76 million people, will all see the illegitimate ways and stand against them.
Shortly before last month's mayoral primary in Pittsburgh, there was an attack ad against City Councilmember Bill Peduto, a Democratic candidate for mayor.
Bill Peduto wants to be mayor of Pittsburgh, but Peduto only seems to care about his own district. Peduto was the only councilmember to vote against helping Homewood seniors, but has diverted money to corporate expansion in his district. Peduto opposed...
Now, attack ads are par for the course during political campaigns, but Tim McNulty, who reports on politics for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, noticed something unprecedented about this one. What was it?
We had never had an outside attack ad in a mayor's race before. In this case, we had an anonymous ad, just like a super PAC ad, going after just a regular old Democratic candidate for mayor.
The ad was paid for by a group called Committee for a Better Pittsburgh.
Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah, I think everyone wants that. But we didn't know where it was coming from. We suspected, however, that it was from this guy Peduto's main rival, the incumbent mayor, a guy named Luke Ravenstahl. But we couldn't prove that he was behind these ads until we did a little digging.
Now, let's talk about that. Last year, the FCC made a decision to require TV stations to post information about political ads online. And that was your way in.
That's right. You know, and we were watching that decision very closely last fall because we had a lot of these same kind of ads in our congressional races around Pittsburgh. We were very familiar with that website, and we used it all the time.
The information about ad buys was already available to the public, but you had to be there in person.
It's very difficult to go into a television station, get past security, go to the general manager's office, find some kind of rusty old filing cabinet and rifle through these papers, especially when you know you're probably not going to find out anything all that interesting. It's sort of a, you know, 1 in 100 shot when you do. So to be able to do that from the office is a whole lot easier.
You were able to find this information in the online version of the public files, but those files weren't perfect, right? They were incomplete?
Yeah, they don't tell you everything. It's like reading Sanskrit to figure it out. They give you just the slightest glimpse into who these groups are and how much money they're spending. I mean, it's a big help. It doesn't get all the way there. It's only the top 50 markets in the country where the TV stations have to provide this info. It's only network television. A lot of political advertising is moving to cable now. You still have to go to cable, you know, stations to see the stuff there. So it's taking us a bit of the way. I'd like to see it go a little bit further.
So what did you see?
Well, we just kept going through them and through them until finally we found a document where the billing to the conservative media firm in Virginia was listed, and who pops up as the chairman of Committee for a Better Pittsburgh but the outgoing mayor and the rival of this guy who was being attacked.
Now, Luke Ravenstahl, the outgoing mayor, is also a Democrat, right?
That's right, but everybody in Pittsburgh's a Democrat, so you don't break down by... Republican or, you know, or Democrat like you usually do. You break down in other ways that are very complicated.
Is Luke Ravenstahl a really rich guy? Where did he get the money for these ads?
As you said, our primary was May 21st, and he didn't drop out until March. And so being an incumbent, he had the biggest war chest in the whole city. He had about $1 million in cash. So he had money to burn, and burn it he did. And he put $150,000 into about a month of attack ads on his rival, even though he wasn't in the race.
But how important is this information anyway to the citizens of Pittsburgh? Does it really matter who paid for the attack ad?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's on, you know, 24/7 on every single local news broadcast, everything. And they're really harsh attacks. And strangely enough, they were by the same firm that did the Swiftboat ads on John Kerry. It offended a lot of Democrats in a Democratic city that the mayor used this firm.
Do you think the ads had an impact?
Well, Peduto, the guy that the mayor was attacking, actually won over his two main rivals for the Democratic nomination. And there's some anecdotal information that these ads might have boosted Peduto because the current mayor is so incredibly unpopular.
Do you think that if everybody knew who paid for these ads all the time, it would actually have the effect of educating the electorate?
Certainly you have to go beyond just these names of the people paying for the ads are. You need some people, you know, like us to help explain who these people are and what they're trying to accomplish. But yeah, it helps out a lot. There's a nonprofit out there that I'll give a plug to called the Sunlight Foundation. You can put in the name of your TV market and it'll send you an update every single time a new ad is filed in your city so you don't have to go and check it by yourself every time.
If the voters knew who was behind every ad, do you think that would reduce the impact of political advertising?
It might. It's a real uphill battle. I mean, the laws are against the public finding out about most of this stuff. And even this FCC rule only provides just a small bit of information to build upon, but it's really all we have. And the other thing that's kind of sad about it is that the actual campaigns and the committees themselves have media buyers who track all of this stuff for them. It's the public, it's reporters who have to go out and do all of this, you know, digging.
Thank you very much.
No problem.
Tim McNulty is a political reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Coming up, the media in Iran gear up for the first election since the Green Revolution was quashed.
There has been very long debates, and the first one ended in a fiasco because it was the short question and answer format, and some of the candidates basically refused to answer to some of the questions, and they said the questions are wrong.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at GatesFoundation.org. The Pew Charitable Trusts, working to protect the health of the world's oceans and of the coastal communities that depend on them, at PewTrust.org, and the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at Hewlett.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The Iranian presidential election is a week away, the first one since the 2009 polling, when a police crackdown on protests known as the Green Revolution left many dead and jailed. Authorities in Iran seem to be doing everything they can to restrict the free flow of information in the country in the hopes that it can prevent a repeat of 2009. Gulnaz Esfandiari is a senior correspondent for Radio Free Europe and editor of the Persian Letters blog. She's been following the media in the run-up to the vote.
At least one or two of the presidential candidates have, during their TV appearances, criticized censorship on state TV, which is quite interesting.
These candidates are given equal time on state TV.
Yes.
Tell me what that looks like.
They appear in different shows. There has been very long debates, and the first one ended in a fiasco because it was a short question and answer format, and some of the candidates basically refused to answer to some of the questions, and they said the questions are wrong. And there was a very funny part where the presenter would show some pictures to the candidates, and they would have to describe or speak about whatever came to their mind, which ended up being very
funny. They
did
a Rorschach test of presidential candidates on national television.
Exactly. It was a presidential Rorschach test, and these debates has led to lots of jokes among Iranians.
I understand that the election videos of even these hand-selected candidates were censored by the state for what exactly?
One of the candidates, his name is Mohsen Rezaei. He's loyalist to Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, so he's very much in line with the establishment. He apparently, in his campaign video, was talking about poverty in the Iranian society, and he recalled meeting a man who had lost a few of his children in the Iran-Iraq war. And he apparently said that the man told him that if the situation continues as it is and he can't feed his family, then he would commit suicide. And Rezaei's website reported that that sentence was cut from his campaign video.
Is the issue of the sanctions by the U.S. and other Western countries against Iran over its nuclear ambitions, is that an issue in the campaign?
It is, because the economy is the main issue for Iranians. They complain about the rising prices and how difficult life is getting for them. Many people say that the sanctions are hurting ordinary Iranians instead of the regime.
The sanctions affecting the general populace as opposed to the elites is actually always the idea, isn't it? To put political pressure from the body politic on the people making the decisions. Yet there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of backlash towards the ruling clerics. Is the Iranian public feeling just defeated?
There's a sense of disillusionment among many, especially of the young people. Some believe that they can't make a change. Others are so busy with day-to-day life that they say, I don't care about politics. And there's also not a real candidate that can mobilize people at this point. The state crackdown of 4 years ago, it's ongoing. It's not being reported in the media, but there's still arrests, there's still people being summoned by intelligence officials. And the government has had 4 years to get ready for this election. They've created new bodies to monitor social media.
Now, the Ayatollah Khamenei has denounced social media as a Zionist tool, and yet the ruling elite is getting into social media. How are they doing that?
Khamenei himself or his people who work on his team has been using Twitter to spread his message for a few years now. He's also very active on Google+. He has an Instagram account, also a Facebook account, Saeed Jalili, which is by far the most hardline of the eight candidates. He's very active on social media. But the thing is that none of them would acknowledge that these are official accounts. Often they write these accounts are being maintained by the supporters. As for Ayatollah Khamenei, it's the same. His people are never going to say, yes, we are working on this account. But it was reported by a few sources inside the country that, for example, his Facebook is run by his media people.
I'd love to see his Pinterest. I'm just dying to know what he's pinned. Gulnaz, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Gulnaz Esfandiari is a senior correspondent for Radio Free Europe.
One way the Iranian government has been trying to ensure a smooth election is by slowing down the internet to a nearly unusable speed. 2 minutes to load Gmail, downloads cut off midway through a photo. This is in addition to blocking Iranians from Facebook, Twitter, and thousands of international news sites. An Iranian blogger who goes by the name of Nariman Gharib left his homeland for London 2 years ago. From there, he connects with people still in Iran to help them find workarounds to the Iranian filternet. I asked him about the impact of the U.S. decision last week to lift sanctions on the sales of communication technologies. He laughed.
The problem is this. When you want to create account on, for example, Apple Store or Android, you need to enter your credit card number or PayPal. But the problem is the Iranian inside the Iran, they haven't any credit card or PayPal account. And if you want to take a transaction in the internet, okay, this is a sanction. You can't have a direct transaction between Iran and U.S.
Let me see if I have this straight. Yeah. The U.S. government says you can buy Apple products, but you can't do direct bank transactions. So you need to use a credit card or PayPal. But you don't have credit cards or PayPal in Iran. So America says, come and buy Apple products, and offers them no means to do it.
Yeah, exactly. That people can't do anything. Just antivirus and software like that, they can not update.
They can get free updates, but anything that costs money, they can't get because America still has sanctioned any direct banking relationships.
Yeah, exactly.
So no impact at all there. Do you expect a repeat of 2009?
I don't think so, because most of the activists and most of the journalists now are in the prison or outside Iran, and there isn't any leaders that say to people, okay, we're going to the street next week or on Monday or Sunday or something.
So what will people use the communication tools that you give them for?
Nowadays, most of the young people use these tools for Facebook and Twitter. The government just think, oh, all of the users inside the Iran use the Facebook for protests or something. But it's not like this. They listen to music, and you can see most popular Iranian page on Facebook just for fun.
They just want your tools so they can function in a fairly normal way online. And that's it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's it. Yeah.
So why are you doing this? You've been forced to flee the country. You'll probably never be able to go back, at least not for years and years. If most people are using your tools just to gain a measure of privacy, not to foment revolution, why do you bother?
You can see when they come online, they change when they connect to internet. When my friends online, they can talk to me like a sister or brother. They relax on something. But if the internet is disconnected, they think they are alone in the world, you know.
So it's for connection, for its own sake.
Yeah, I love my people. I want to give them the opportunity, and they can see what's happening in the US, what's happening in Europe, and what's happening in the rest of the world, and they can learn new things.
Nariman, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We spoke to the Iranian blogger and social media researcher known as Nariman Gharib from London. Doubts about the fairness of Iran's 2009 election led to a great protest movement, the so-called Green Revolution, that prompted much hope abroad and ultimately much despair inside Iran. Early in the bloody crackdown, there was a famous killing and a case of mistaken identity. Last fall, we spoke to the woman who was not killed, but who suffered another kind of death.
Posted to YouTube and other internet sites, the first shocking snippet of cell phone video ran less than a minute, with voices shouting, Netta has been shot. Netta, don't be scared. Then, Netta, stay alive.
Time magazine called it probably the most widely witnessed death in human history. Protesters across the globe held posters of her image, vowing her death would not be in vain. But on many of those posters, and in countless news reports, it wasn't her face on display. It was the face of another young Iranian, a woman named Neda Soltani, who was very much alive. That Neda was working at a university in Iran when her photo was lifted from her Facebook page and mistakenly used to put a face to the fallen protester. Now living in exile, she says that at the time of the 2009 demonstrations, she wasn't even a political activist.
I did not even vote in that election.
When did you become aware of the death of the other Neda?
The morning after she was shot to death, I had almost 300 Facebook friendship invitations from all over the world. I started receiving phone calls from friends, students, colleagues who broke down on the phone once they heard my voice, because they had prepared themselves to call and hear that I had been killed.
They were seeing you on Iranian channels, Fox News, CNN.
Exactly.
Were they seeing
you?
It was my face. And of course, at the beginning, it was my name as well. So they were calling the real victim, who is Neda Agha Sultan, with my name, Neda Sultani. And they were using my photo to be the face of opposition.
These images of you weren't just used in the media. Demonstrators began to use your picture during the protests. Alongside the graphic images of the deceased Neda, they held your picture with the words, "Neda did not die in vain."
Exactly.
What was that like?
It was like watching my own funeral. The mental image that I could be dead. That was a very, very terrifying experience. On the other hand, it was very shocking because I could not believe my face would wrongly go all over the world as the symbol of opposition, which I was not.
You were just the quiet scholar of English literature.
That was the life that I had.
What did you do?
Together with several people, we started writing emails, blogs, made phone calls, talked to TV producers. Nobody listened to us. So even after the family of the deceased, Neda, provided several photos of her, the international media kept using my photo.
Tell me about some of your experiences to try to get this fixed.
Two different people contacted two different producers from CNN and talked to them in length about the mistake. CNN kept broadcasting my photo. When I sent a second photo of mine to Voice of America Farsi channel, and I asked them to compare the photo to see that I was not fabricating the story, to my terror and shock, the next evening, I saw that they broadcasted the second photo as an exclusive photo of the deceased Neda.
Did they explain?
Nothing. Nobody ever wrote back. Nobody ever apologized.
So here you are trying to correct this. How did people respond besides ignoring you?
We started receiving hate mails for distorting the face of a true hero. People were arguing that I was an agent of the Islamic Republic, that the photo did not belong to me. They had seen it everywhere on the media. Of course, they would believe the media. People started calling me a whore, a bitch, a slut, whatever you can imagine. It really killed me emotionally. And then my situation got dangerous once the Iranian Secret Service realized that there has been a mistake. They came for me and they started trying to use what has happened to me to their own advantage.
What did they want from you?
They wanted to use my story to claim that that video is Western propaganda. And that poor innocent woman had not been killed in the first place. That, look, people, this is the photo you have seen, and this is the person who owns the photo. The whole thing is fake. I did not cooperate, and they charged me with treason, which in Iran can bring about death penalty. One of those agents told me that, look, when it comes to the national security of our Islamic fatherland, you and your fate as an individual does not count. I had friends who started telling me that I needed a backup plan in case things go wrong, and they arranged for my escape.
Is there any way that this can be avoided?
Social networks are an indispensable part of modern life. So you cannot get life to a pre-social networking era anymore. But what always surprises me is how carelessly and how recklessly the data that comes out of these social networking systems like Facebook, like Twitter, are being used by very, very professional journalists. There are such times that you start doubting media in general.
You think? So is the Iranian government even today still insisting that the death of Nehra was just propaganda from the West?
Yes, they do. They claim that Nehra Agha Sultan was alive and she was living in Germany, which is me.
Do you think you'll ever go back?
I'm very hopeful.
What did you leave behind?
I left behind my family. I left behind my friends. I left behind my job. I left behind my world. I have to live the rest of my life in the shadow of a person that I am not.
Do you think about her much?
She's part of me. I go through life with her.
What does that feel like?
Sad. Not for myself, but for her. Because life is a blessing. And I so wholeheartedly wish that this second chance that has been granted me to build up a new life from scratch, no matter how uncertain it is, I wholeheartedly wish that it had been granted her as well.
Thank you so much.
You're most welcome.
Nehra Sultani is a visiting scholar at Montclair State University and author of My Stolen Face, the story of a dramatic mistake.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary. We had more help from Olivia Wheats and Molly Buckley. And the show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. And our boss, bassist-composer Ben Allison, wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.